But I want to begin just with a quick review of the various coordinate systems we use. There are too many of them, and I want to just review them so everybody is on the same page about what the various coordinates mean. There's, of course, Schwarzschild coordinates, which I haven't written down. Those most people know, and they're very straightforward. For Schwarzschild coordinates, the coordinate R simply represents the radius of the two-sphere at each point. And by radius of two-sphere, I don't mean the proper distance from the origin. I mean the thing which goes into the usual formula for the area of the two-sphere. That's little r. T, that's ordinary time. And it has the property that, first of all, there is a time translation associated with it. Secondly, asymptotically at large distances, when you're far from the black hole, it just goes to conventional time. So those are the Schwarzschild coordinates. And they're particularly convenient for studying the black hole at a great distance. In particular, the time is just conventional time. All right, now what are the other types of coordinates? They sort of fall into two families, form a sort of two-by-two matrix of different kinds of coordinates. The columns can be called polar coordinates, a polar kind of description, where, now polar means hyperbolic, Lorentzian polar, or conformal. And they're very closely related to each other, the polar and the conformal. That's the vertical columns. And the horizontal parts of the matrix are not New Hampshire, but near horizon over here, and global over here. Near horizon simply means looking at a point near the horizon. There are approximate coordinates near the horizon. And the global versions of the same things which continue out away from the horizon are just labeled G. Okay, so here they are. The near horizon polar coordinate representation is in terms of the proper distance from the horizon rho, a hyperbolic angular coordinate, which is closely related to Schwarzschild time. It's simply rescaled Schwarzschild time, rescaled by, in fact, twice the Schwarzschild radius. And the metric near the horizon is just rho, I'm sorry, this is rho squared. Rho squared, the omega squared, minus d rho squared. And it looks familiar as polar coordinate with omega being hyperbolic angle. Okay? So that's near horizon. The global version of the same thing are the Kruskal coordinates. And the Kruskal coordinates are defined in terms of a capital R. Capital R is defined in such a way that capital R squared times f of r near the horizon is just rho squared. Okay? So capital R is a kind of generalization of rho. And of course, I have not bothered writing down the angular part of the metric. The angular part of the metric is always little r squared times the omega squared. Okay, so I haven't bothered writing down the angular part. All right, so the Kruskal coordinates are also polar type coordinates. And capital R is just defined so as to make this formula work everywhere it's on the plane. Omega is still a hyperbolic angle. It's still T over 4mg. And capital R here, here's the correct formula for capital R, which I somehow lost last time. Mg e to the R star over 4mg, but I haven't told you what R star is yet. Okay, but in any case, these are also polar type coordinates with an extra factor f of r standing out in front of them. Okay, in the other column, we have conformal coordinates. Oh, we could draw a picture for these coordinates here. The picture for these coordinates is always looks like this. A light cone and lines of constant either rho or r are hyperbolas in here. Lines of constant omega are straight lines emanating out from the center. And of course, they accumulate near the light cones. Omega equals infinity. This shouldn't pass through the origin. They should all pass through the origin, of course. And they look like that, at least in the first quadrant of the plane here. They can be extended into the second, third, and fourth quadrant. And to extend them into the second, third, and fourth quadrant, you have to remember that there's an inversion of space and time because of the change of sign of the metric in the Schwarzschild metric. So little r, big r, or rho, or whatever they are, point outward here, they point upward here, and to continue the coordinates into the various regions is more or less straightforward. You're familiar with these things from ordinary Minkowski space, so I won't belabor them. To go from the polar coordinates to the conformal coordinates is straightforward. What we would like to do is to have an overall factor multiplying something that looks just like Minkowski space or that looks like flat space. So all we do is define a new radial variable so that the coefficient in front of the radial variable here will also be rho squared. So we just write that d rho is equal to rho times du. The solution to that, of course, is rho is equal to e to the u. And then the same metric here is just e to the 2u, that's just rho squared, times the omega squared, same thing as here. Sorry, this is du squared, isn't it? Du squared. So this now looks like flat space multiplied by a conformal factor. This can be extremely useful in writing wave equations, to have the metric in this form. And the global version of that, in other words, the version which is not the near horizon version, is very similar. It can be obtained from this side in terms of the tortoise coordinate r star. Here's the tortoise coordinate r star correctly written. In tortoise coordinates, and this is simply a convention, incidentally, it's a historical convention that the tortoise coordinates are written in terms of t rather than omega, and an r star, which is normalized in a way that goes together with t. So it's a historical convention that you don't use omega for these conformal coordinates here, you use t. But the relation between t and omega is straightforward, it is just t is equal to 4mg times omega. Now, in terms of these conformal coordinates, the radial coordinate doesn't run from 0 to infinity. It runs from minus infinity to infinity. And at minus infinity, this is either true for u or for r star, for either one of them. Minus infinity is the horizon. Now, the near horizon coordinate u, it doesn't make much sense to extend very far from the horizon, because by definition, it's an approximate coordinate near the horizon. But nevertheless, do think of moving in this direction, it's moving out from the black hole. On the other hand, the r star coordinate can be extended out to infinity. So r star goes to infinity is just infinity, far from the black hole. Notice that far from the black hole where r is large, r star and r are essentially the same apart from the logarithm. So that's the set of coordinates. And before I go on to new material, let me just ask if there are any questions about these coordinates. They're all useful. They all have their various values. Not their values, their value. Okay, good. So if that much is clear, we can now move on to, let's see if I can reach this. see, now we have that up there, I have this board here, then I'll fill up this board. By that time, that one will be not interesting anymore. Then I'll lift this one, and we'll have the bottom. This took me 15 years to realize. Penrose diagrams, which should be called Carter-Penrose diagrams, because Brandon Carter was one of the co-inventors of Penrose Carter-Penrose diagrams. But, you know, as always happens, somebody gets lost in the shuffle, and we tend to call them Penrose diagrams. And I'll probably forget to put Brandon Carter in as one of the inventors, but it's only fair to mention right now that Brandon was one of the co-inventors of this idea. All right, so the idea, I'm sure most of you know, but let's just go through it anyway. The idea is to take all of space-time, and this is particularly useful for radially symmetric space-time, so spherically symmetric space-times, to take the whole thing and do a coordinate transformation that pulls it all onto the finite plane so that we can draw all of space-time on the blackboard. That's one thing, so it's called a compactification. It's not got anything to do with compactifications in string theory. It's just taking all of space-time and putting it in coordinates where you can draw on the blackboard. But the other thing is, when you do it, you want to make sure that you preserve the structure of light cones. Right? The light cones continue to be 45-degree axes, continue to be 45-degree things. All right, so let's begin with flat space. Flat space and polar coordinates, here's the origin, r equals 0. R goes to infinity out here. It's a light cone. And at every point of space, at every point of this RT plane, this is the RT plane, here's t equals infinity. Here's t equals minus infinity. At every point on this plane, there's associated with it a two-sphere of radius r, which we can't draw because we can't draw it. Okay, now let's take this plane and define the coordinates t plus or minus r to be called t plus or minus. And notice that light rays, or actually light shells, you could think of them, light shells correspond either to t plus equals a constant or t minus equals a constant. T plus equals a constant are incoming light shells. T minus a constant are outgoing light shells. So T plus or minus a constant is a light shell. I want to make a coordinate transformation on this, but I want to keep the light cones at 45 degrees. And that means what I'd like to do is to make transformations of the form y plus or minus are functions separately. Y plus is a function of t plus, and y minus is a function of t minus. In fact, I'll use the same function. It'll give us a nice symmetry in the problem, so that some function f is chosen, so that new coordinates, y plus and y minus, are simply functions of the old t plus and t minus. Obviously, if t plus is a constant, then y plus is a constant. If t minus is a constant, then y minus is a constant. And so the structure of light cones will be maintained. But we're going to use a coordinate so that when t plus goes to infinity, y plus goes to something constant. In particular, y plus goes to 1 is a nice choice. A simple and equal, there are many functions you could use, and anything that you like, really. But a nice function to use is that this is equal to hyperbolic tangent of t plus minus. So that when t plus minus goes to infinity, y plus minus just goes to 1. Then this whole plane is a triangle, becomes a triangle. When t plus goes to infinity, when you're way out there where I can't reach, but Jean-Marc can reach, then you're moving way out to y plus equals 1. That's over here. And likewise, y minus equals 1 is down here. So the whole thing gets mapped to a triangle. That's all of space. let's just get some terminology. This is called time-like infinity, and it's the place where all time-like trajectories go. All time-like trajectories going straight up, for example, pass to this point up here. There's a t minus infinity down here. And if we were to draw what corresponds to the vertical lines on the original diagram here, they would look like this. And of course, there's an infinite number of them, so they pile up over here. Now I'm going to make use of colored chalk that people brought me. All right, what about the horizontal lines, the lines of constant time over here? They all go out to r equals infinity. This is called r equals infinity here, and they look like this. Again, they pile up as you go to t equals infinity. So you get more and more and more of them. I'm imagining that these surfaces here correspond to uniform intervals of the original time. And they pile up as you get to time equals infinity. There's a symmetry. The symmetry is time translation invariance. And time translation invariance acts to slide you along these time-like trajectories here. So that's the Penrose, or the Carter-Penrose diagram describing flat space. Let's add a couple of things onto it. Just one thing, light rays. Right. Light rays come in along 45 degree angles. Let's speak about light shells or radial light rays. Radially moving light rays come in from the light cone over here. This is called light-like negative infinity I minus, and this is called light-like positive infinity I plus, sometimes called script I minus or script I plus, or probably the ugliest term, the ugliest word in the physicist's vocabulary, scry minus and scry plus. Okay, that's these places. Light rays come in from scry minus and they go out to scry plus. A radial light ray will pass through the origin. And so a radial light ray will hit the origin and go back out. And it'll always go back along a 45 degree angle. A light ray that misses the origin, if you want to think about light rays which miss the origin, but then plot them on the RT plane, they would come in from infinity along the same line, but then miss the origin and go back out. And this is just plotting. I mean, this would be the distance of closest approach to the origin of a light ray which had a non-zero impact parameter, so to speak. Okay, so that's flat space-time. Now, to construct the Penrose diagram for a Schwarzschild black hole, we do exactly the same transformation on the Kruskal plane. We take the Kruskal coordinates, which also cover an infinite plane. The only unusual thing is that there were singularities on it. Singularities were hyperboloids, space-like hyperboloids. And we perform exactly the same kind of operation, just compactify the whole thing with exactly the same transformation will work perfectly well. And here's what the diagram looks like for the Schwarzschild black hole. Now, I want to remind you that there's something very funny going on here. Flat space only looked like half of this. Remember that there is a two-sphere at every point on here. There's a dip. The left-hand side of it is not the backside of the two-sphere. The left-hand side of it is another space, the other space carrying its own local two-sphere. Two-sphere over here, two-sphere over here. Somehow, the black hole geometry has doubled the number of asymptotic regions. There's an asymptotic region out here, each one with its local two-sphere, and there's an asymptotic region over here, also with its local two-sphere. There's too much space. There are too many regions. There's an interesting point, I might as well spell it out right over here. An observer who starts on the outside of the black hole can, in region one, cannot get to region three. Cannot pass through it. He can't exceed the speed of light, and so even if he tries to get through, he'll wind up hitting the singularity. This is called a non-traversable wormhole between two asymptotically flat spaces. You can't get from one to another. But when we come to think about real black holes, we'll find out that half this diagram doesn't mean anything anyway. Okay, let's take the Kruskal diagram, compactify it, subject to the rule that light rays should propagate along 45-degree angles, and it looks like this. Okay. Again, region one is over here. This is the outside of the black hole. This is t equals minus infinity. This is t equals plus infinity. If I were to plot Schwarzschild constant R lines, constant R lines would look like this. These are constant R of Schwarzschild. They're also constant rho, constant all the other various radial coordinates. And constant time, or constant omega, would look like this on the outside of a black hole. Here's a singularity. Oh, this is called R equals infinity. This again is called scribe plus. This is again called scribe minus. Now light rays can come in, or anything else can come in, and they can pass right into this region number two here. Region number two is the interior behind the black hole horizon. How do you see that? Well, imagine that you're in region number one, and you've got a flashlight or laser. You can send the light ray outward. An outward light ray goes like that. It escapes. It escapes to infinity. You can also send a light ray inward. No surprise, a light ray that goes inward will crash into the singularity. That's not surprising. Nobody says that from outside you can't send something inside, but from outside you can also send something out. In region two, any light ray, whether it's an outward-directed light ray or an inward-directed light ray, will eventually crash into the singularity. And for that matter, any time-like trajectory will also crash into the singularity. And so this region here, region two, is the region behind the horizon of the black hole. And notice that the singularity is kind of an end of time. The singularity is not a place, it's a time. There's a singularity in your future, so to speak, once you get inside the black hole. And you can't avoid it. So that's the Penrose diagram describing the extended Schwarzschild solution. The extended Schwarzschild solution just means you take the whole Kruskal diagram. Now, any questions up to this point? Good. Now let's talk about real black holes. Well, not quite real black holes. We're going to make a black hole by a process which I've never actually heard of really happening in space, but it could happen. Instead of having a star collapse, let's collapse a radial shell of infalling light, a light-like radial shell coming in. The reason is that it's simple, that it's easy. It's an easy way to form a black hole in which the mathematics can be carried out completely with just very, very elementary mathematics. It's easier than the formation of a collapsing star, but otherwise, it really is very simple. All right, here's how you do it. You start, we're going to use a theorem. The theorem is Newton's theorem, except in the context of general relativity. Yeah.
So, are we supposed to imagine the other half of the...
Are we supposed to imagine what?
The other half of the diagram doesn't exist.
We're going to come to that now. Yeah. At the moment, We're doing, at the moment, we can call this a mathematical study of a space. Now we come to the question, how do you make such a space? How do you construct such a space? And if you did construct such a space, how much of it would really be there? So we're going to talk about the creation of the black hole. And what we're going to find out is really less than half of it is physical. Not the full half of it. Not half of it, but less than half of it. OK, so here's our game. We're going to use Newton's theorem in the form of general relativity, in which it's called Birkhoff's theorem. What does Newton's theorem say, first of all? Newton's theorem says that if you're interested in the gravitational field of a spherically symmetric object, you needn't worry about anything outside the sphere that you're interested in. You need only worry about the stuff inside the sphere. In particular, if you have a shell, even if it's a moving shell, if you're inside the shell, there is no gravitational field, and all you have is, well, I would call it flat space-time, except that it's just Newtonian empty space with no gravitational field. Newton's theorem also says that if you're outside the same shell, you see the exact field of a point mass at the center. Birkhoff's theorem is the generalization of that. It says inside a shell, you see flat space-time. Outside a shell, you see the Schwarzschild metric. Okay, the Schwarzschild metric associated with the mass of the shell. That's even true as the shell falls in. As the shell falls in, at any given time, at any given instant, everything outside the shell is Schwarzschild. Everything inside the shell is flat space-time. So this becomes an exercise, if you like, in patching together the interior solution of the shell, which is flat space-time up on the top, and the exterior of the shell, which is the Schwarzschild metric. So let's go over here and start with flat space-time. Here's flat space-time. And let's throw in a light-like shell of, it could be radiation, but anything that forms a shell that moves in with the speed of light. And it will look like this. The interior of the shell is down here. The exterior of the shell is here. Just imagine an instant of time. Here's an instant of time. At that instant of time, outside the shell is here, inside the shell is here. So everything below the pink line is inside the shell of incoming matter. And therefore, according to Birkhoff's theorem, it's flat space-time. Outside the shell, we've made a mistake by making flat space-time. So what we're going to do is we're going to cut this geometry with the scissors. And we're going to remove the part that we've gotten wrong. Just remove it. Throw it away. Now, let's take the black hole, which is supposed to be what is on the outside. Let me redraw that. And from the outside, throw in a shell. There's the shell of incoming light. Now the outside is physical and is correctly described by the Schwarzschild metric. The inside is incorrectly described. So we're going to throw away the inside. Then we're going to match these together on the pink line. Now, before we match them together on the pink line, we have to do a little bit of conformal transforming, squeezing in various directions, in order that the size of the local two-sphere at each point matches the size of the local two-sphere at each point here. But that's an easy exercise. You just do a conformal transformation, which simply means a transformation which keeps the light cones fixed, but, for example, which slides you along this direction until the size of the local two-spheres match at each point here. So what we're going to do then And that's an easy thing to do. It doesn't make any big change in geometry. We throw away this. We throw away this, and we patch them together. The result looks like singularity. With the shell coming in here. Let's draw the shell in pink. The shell is coming in here. So everything above the pink shell is exactly the same as over here. Everything below the pink shell is exactly the same as over here, with some minor coordinate conformal transformation to make things match across the boundary here. This is the Penrose diagram for the formation of a black hole. If it was the formation by something more complicated than the shell, it would still look very similar and not worth telling you very much about what the difference is. Okay, now let's come to the concept of the horizon. Previously, we just said the horizon was at point 2mg, r equals 2mg. That was correct for the static black hole. The static black hole, the infinite eternal black hole, if you're inside, this line very close to here is r equals 2mg. If you're inside that line, you're trapped. Okay? But the correct definition of a horizon is more general than that. The correct definition of an event horizon is the separator of all of the places where you could send the light ray out from all the places where you can't send the light ray out. In other words, those places where you're trapped from those places where you're not trapped. And if you were to draw that on here, it's simply a 45-degree line. It completely agrees with the horizon above the pink line. Above the pink line, it completely agrees with the original horizon. But below the pink line, there was no horizon in the original flat space. There is a horizon now, and that horizon begins in flat space. It expands, it starts out infinitely shrunken, the local two-sphere at the origin is zero size, and starts to expand. It expands until it gets out to the Schwarzschild radius. When it gets out to the Schwarzschild radius, remember that this line, at every point along that line, the two-sphere has the same size, and it is the local two-sphere corresponding to the Schwarzschild radius. So the horizon grows along here, and then it stops growing when it gets past the shell. That's the definition of the horizon. If you're in here, even though the shell hasn't gotten to you yet, even though you're in perfectly flat space, you cannot escape. No way to escape from there, so you're inside the horizon. Okay, that's the, let's explore it a little bit further. Let's put in two observers. One observer is a free-falling observer, a free foe, and that free-falling observer falls into the black hole and, of course, gets killed at the singularity over here. Bye-bye. The other observer stays outside the black hole. He's a phyto. He stays outside and looks like that. Right. Now, the amount of proper time to this point is quite finite. But the amount of proper time to this point is infinite. So if I were to tick off proper time along here, it would accumulate over here, meaning to say that proper time on this diagram would get closer and closer spaced. And now think about the observer on the outside looking back, and following the freely falling observer. Let me erase some lines, too many lines up here. Well, this is what I don't need. The thing which made the black hole. All right, so the observer outside, time is going on, it's getting later and later and later and later, time is going to infinity, he looks back along the light cone and sees the infalling observer, and obviously never sees the infalling observer cross the horizon. Watching him from this point here, it would take an infinite amount of time to observe a signal coming from very close to the horizon, and there is no chance of ever observing a signal from behind the horizon. So this observer here would say it simply took an infinite amount of time to fall through the horizon. It also corresponds to an infinite amount of Schwarzschild time, because Schwarzschild time goes to infinity along this same line here. Okay? It's interesting to ask what the informing observer sees if he looks back at the outgoing, at the other observer. And most, whenever I teach this subject at Stanford to undergraduates or to sometimes to graduate students, their natural assumption is that if the outside observer sees the inside observer slow down, and of course he does see him slow down, this might be a billion years from here to here. It looks back and sees 1 second of proper time transpire. So in a billion years of the external observer, he sees the internal observer 1 second of time go by. He sees her clock slow down infinitely. The question is, what does the infalling observer see about the outside observer? And natural assumption is that you would see the outside observer speed up. No, that's not true. This observer falling in here sees nothing special about the outside observer. Looks back, sees nothing special going on. What is special is that observer comes to an end of time. He can only see so much of the trajectory of the outside observer, but does not tend to see any speed up or slow down. Okay? So it's not a reciprocal speed up and slow down for an infalling and an external observer. Let's draw another picture. There's another picture which is worth drawing. It's not one which I find mathematically very useful. Let's see, let's pull this up. Am I in the third one? No, that's the third one, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's come back to here. Once you get used to Penrose diagrams, you don't like anything else. You hate looking at any other pictures of black holes or anything else. But until you get used to them, there's another picture that some people find useful. Here it is. A light shell comes in to flat space-time. Here's flat space-time, and a light shell comes in. Same process. This is a shell of infalling light rays. They carry energy. They carry mass. And so that shell is a source of gravitation, it's a source of curvature, it's a source of bending of light. Now, what happens to light rays that are going out from the center? Light rays that are going out from the center, when they hit the shell, something happens to them. They get bent. They get bent upward. They get bent in an upward trajectory like that by the shell. This is the focusing theorem for those who know about it. Light gets bent up. And if you're way out far, where the shell is very diffuse, the energy density of the shell is very diffuse out here, you only get a little bit of bend up. If you send a light ray from very close to here, the light ray will get bent so much that it'll get sent back toward the origin. There is some point where the light ray will get bent upward, vertically upward. Vertically upward means that if you were to follow that light shell, if you were to follow the light cone that originated at this point, got bent up here, there would be no expansion of it or no contraction of it. It would simply stay at a fixed size, and that's the horizon. That's the horizon of the black hole. If you send the light ray from in here, it will get sent back. So somewhere in the middle is the singularity, but this is a bad diagram because the singularity is not time-like. Inside the black hole, space and time have gotten inverted. But nevertheless, it's nice to look at the diagram anyway. It's on the RT, whatever, Schwarzschild RT plane. And so that would be roughly what the formation of a black hole by an infalling light shell would look like. Right over here, there's a surface. That surface is the point. It's not the point where the horizon begins. The horizon begins before that, but at that point, the horizon stops growing. It grows up to that point and it stops growing. Next, I want to talk about momentum. The momentum of an object as it falls toward the horizon of a black hole. I want you to imagine there's a bunch of Fidos distributed throughout space with their clocks, with their apparatuses. We are Fidos. We are Fidos because we're not falling through the Earth. All right, we're fixed. We're fixed, and we have our watches, and we have our measuring rods, and so forth. And so we're fiducial observers. What do we observe when something falls? We observe its momentum increase, its downward momentum increase. How much does its downward momentum increase? Well, in falling to the surface of the Earth, it increases by a modest amount that we know how to calculate. Question is, what happens to the momentum of a infalling, freely falling object as it approaches the horizon? So that's an exercise we can do using using the near horizon geometry. I'm only going to be interested in near the horizon. Okay, so we're near the horizon. Near the horizon, let's just remind ourselves what the metric looks like near the horizon. It looks like flat space. It looks like flat space. I won't even bother writing the metric. It looks like flat space near a point on the horizon. Near a point on the horizon. Looks like flat space. There's a z coordinate. There's a t coordinate. And there's also an x and a y coordinate that come out of the blackboard, which I won't draw. Z is equal to rho, proper distance, times cos omega, and t is equal to rho sinh omega. But what I'm actually interested in is the different derivatives, d by d rho, which is equal to cos omega times d by dz plus sinh omega d by d t. I'm not interested in the other derivative, just d by d rho. The reason I'm interested in the differential d by d rho is because d by d rho is momentum, right? Momentum transforms in the same way that derivatives transform. So we can read off this immediately that the component of momentum along the rho direction. Now, what is the rho direction? The rho direction is the radial direction, but also it's measured in proper units. Okay, it's measured in proper units, and so the momentum conjugate to it is a momentum conjugate to a proper distance, and so we could call it proper momentum, proper radial momentum. The proper radial momentum is cos omega times the z component of momentum, plus sinh omega times the t component of momentum. But what is the p and t component of momentum? We're just in flat space, and a particle is falling. It's moving along a straight line in flat space. It just falls through the horizon, but in flat space, it simply moves on a straight line. It has a pz, it has a pt. Let's take the simplest case, where it has no z momentum and is simply moving vertically upward. So it falls through the horizon with no horizontal motion. We can add horizontal motion. Well, let's leave it there. Let's leave pz and pt there. But now let's go to very late time. Very late time means very late omega. Let's go to omega very late. Remember what omega is? Omega is T divided by 4mg, where T is Schwarzschild time. So we're going to very late Schwarzschild time. Both of these are now just exponentials. And this just becomes e to the omega, or e to the t over 4mg, times pz plus pt. Let's forget pz. Let's just have it going vertically upward, times pt. The momentum of an object falling in a gravitational field, as it falls toward the horizon, grows exponentially with time. It's growing exponentially with time as t goes to infinity. T goes to infinity over here, and so it's actually growing as you approach the horizon. Not after you approach the horizon, but as you approach the horizon, it's growing exponentially with time. So the momentum of an object becomes enormous as it falls toward the horizon, very quickly becoming larger than the entire mass of the universe. I invite you to take a solar mass black hole and ask how long it would take for an electron falling through to have a momentum that exceeded the mass of the entire universe. It's not very long. So momentums get enormous. This is something we're going to have to think about. We're going to have to think about the fact that an external observer, a fiducial observer stationed outside a black hole, sees or reckons the momentum of objects to become enormously big with time, super-duper trans-Planckian, way beyond anything that we know how to think about. There's another thing that goes with this. We can also ask, as the particle falls toward the horizon, how the distance from the horizon varies. How does the distance vary from the horizon? It won't surprise you if I tell you that the momentum grows exponentially to tell you that the distance from the horizon of the falling particle goes like e to the minus t over 4mg. In other words, the object approaches the horizon exponentially so that it hugs the horizon closer and closer and closer exponentially, and at the same time, the momentum of the object grows exponentially. This inevitably means, in studying black holes, we're going to get driven to physics, which is way, way beyond the Planck scale. And we're going to have some idea of what to do with that. Any questions up till now? I want to get on now to scalar wave equations in the background of a black hole. We want to do quantum mechanics and quantum field theory in the black hole. No, this doesn't look bad. It stays there for the moment. Okay. So we want to study quantum field theory. First, let's study classical field theory. I want to study classical field theory outside the black hole in the near horizon limit to begin with. Let's start with the near horizon limit, and that simply means flat space. Incidentally, flat space, if we just take region 1 and we parameterize it by omega and rho, is called Rindler space. It is just flat space. It's one quadrant of a flat space. It's called Rindler space. Now, one of the interesting things about Rindler space is you can imagine that it's a self-contained system. You do not have to worry, in studying what goes on in Rindler space, there's a sense in which you don't have to worry about anything outside of the Rindler space, here, here, or here. Well, in what sense is that true? Well, this corresponds to omega equals minus infinity. This corresponds to omega equals plus infinity. Anything that happens in here traces back to some initial data somewhere on the backward light cone. It can always be represented as an initial condition on the backward light cone here. In other words, you can always think of it as an initial condition at omega equals minus infinity. Anything that comes in through here must pass through the surface of initial conditions. And so you can simply think of it as part of the initial data, whatever happens on this backward light cone here. Whatever happens, so anything in here is simply part of the initial conditions, the starting conditions for Rindler space at omega equals minus infinity. Anything that goes out, well, that's just stuff that passed through plus infinity, and so it becomes part of the infinite future. But anything that happens inside can always be traced back to something in the initial conditions, and it will eventually lead to something at asymptotic times. There's nothing that unusual about it. All right, what about things here? Things here can't influence things here altogether. You can't get a signal in there, and you can't even get a signal from there. So Rindler space is, in a certain sense, classically, in any case, a self-contained system. You can do field theory, classical field theory in the Rindler space, setting up initial conditions here, and asking about what happens in the final far future along here, without ever worrying what happens on the outside. Let's set up that problem. Let's set up the action for a quantum field theory in Rindler space, pretending that we knew nothing else about the rest of the world. Okay, so our metric, we begin with our metric. Our metric is e to the 2u, d omega squared minus du squared. I'm using the conformal form, minus dx dx. Instead of using rho, I'm using u, so that the horizon is off at minus infinity. And the reason is because I want to use the metric in conformally flat form. Okay. That's the metric, and now let's set up the action for a minimally coupled scalar field. Here's the action, 1/2 integral du, the omega, dx, dx, just the usual thing, square root of g mu nu, d nu chi, where chi is the scalar field. That's our action, and now we just have to substitute in. Square root of g is just e to the 2u. So that gives us integral e to the 2u. And now the inverse metric for the omega and u components is just e to the minus 2u. So that cancels the square root of g as far as the omega and u derivatives go. That's the standard fact that in conformal coordinates, a two-dimensional quantum field theory is independent of a conformal factor. So that's very easy for the time radial parts of it. It is just 1/2 d chi by d omega squared minus d chi by du squared. But then we still have, for the x components, in other words, the components along the direction of the horizon, omega and u are perpendicular to the horizon, time and radius. X lies along the horizon. Those will still have the square root of g in them. G mu nu for them is just 1, but they'll have square root of g, so they will have minus e to the 2u minus, yes, dx chi squared. So all of the interesting geometry is in this piece, surprisingly, because after all, it just looked like perfectly good flat space. All of the interesting stuff, the e to the 2u's, are in the derivatives along the direction of the horizon. Let me just manipulate this a little more. Since the x direction at the moment is just ordinary flat two-dimensional space, we can do a Fourier analysis of chi along the direction of the horizon. The horizon is just a flat plane in the approximation of the tangent space. We can Fourier analyze things. Later on, of course, we'll do a spherical decomposition. But for the moment, in the near horizon limit, we can just use Fourier analysis for the x directions. And so we can write that that kind is sum or integral of e to the I k dot x, two-dimensional k dot x, times chi sub k of omega and u. The wave equation for chi of k and omega, sorry, chi sub k that I'm interested in other words, Fourier component by Fourier component, I can rewrite the action, and the action becomes 1/2 integral. We integrate out x, x is gone, it's just the omega, the u, and then it's just the chi by the omega squared. This is chi sub k minus the chi by the u k squared. But now I always confuse the sign here. I think it's minus k squared e to the 2u chi sub k squared. K squared just comes from each derivative on chi gives you a k or an ik or whatever it is. Ik and minus ik, yeah, I think it's minus k squared times e to the 2u. We look at this equation and we see what it is. For each value of k, it has a mass term. But the mass term depends on u. And it grows bigger and bigger as you move out away from the black hole. It exponentially grows. It's proportional to k squared. Only k equals 0 has no mass term. If a field has a mass term which grows bigger and bigger and bigger, it's quite obvious the field can't penetrate into that region. It becomes a potential barrier. Only k equals 0 can escape from the black hole. Only k equals 0, in this approximation, only k equals 0, only things which are moving absolutely radially outward or moving perpendicular to the horizon have any chance of getting out, because every other k mode has an exponentially growing potential. Now,
if you had a mass, it would be also.
The mass would even make it worse. Exactly. We can, of course, a k squared works exactly the same way as the mass term does, right? Well, it works exactly the same way as the mass term. Great. So let's just think about this for a moment. Here's our space. What does a mass term do to a particle? It makes it move on a time-like trajectory. All time-like trajectories look like this. Well, how do we plot this? If we wanted to plot this on the u omega plane. The particle comes in from the horizon. That's u equals minus infinity. It pops out as far as it can get, and it falls back in. So on the u plane, if a particle has a time-like trajectory like this, it means it starts at minus infinity, goes in, and turns around. It can't get out. It can only get out if it's massless, and not only if it's massless, but if its momentum is perfectly radially outward, or perfectly perpendicular to the horizon. Then it moves on a light-like trajectory and it gets out. So that's the meaning of this term here. It's the thing which effectively turns a particle around and makes it fall back into the horizon. We're going to find the same thing in black holes. What we're going to find is that higher angular momentum. What does radially outward mean? Radially outward means zero angular momentum. Zero angular momentum, we'll find, gets out easily. Higher angular momentum tends to get reflected back into the black hole. Now, this is a funny thing. Things getting reflected back into the black hole, it almost sounds like an upside-down centrifugal barrier, something that pulls you in rather than pushes you out. Yeah.
I'm just drawing it in my head.
What's that?
It's okay.
Is it?
I was just making a little sketch to myself.
Oh, okay. Let's look at the wave equation. Omega is time, so the wave equation has the form. And let's look at the wave equation, and let's look at a specific frequency. Let's look at a specific frequency going like, oh, I hate this notation, going like e to the I nu omega. Mm. Nu is the frequency, omega is the time. Sorry about that. But I think you're all grown up enough to be able to do that switch in your heads, right? Omega is time, and I'm glad I don't have to do this with undergraduates. It would drive me crazy. Nu is frequency, but nu is a remember, omega is a dimensionless time. So this is frequency in dimensionless units, okay, for the moment. Later on, we're going to do things in dimensional units. All right, but if we choose a particular frequency, here's what the wave equation will look like. It's the time-independent equation for a particular frequency. It's just simple. It's just minus d second u of chi plus k squared e to the 2u chi equals nu squared chi. It's just a Schrodinger equation. It's a Schrodinger equation where the energy eigenvalue is replaced by nu squared, and the potential as a positive potential, which is k squared times e to the 2u. So you see just from the Schrodinger point of view that this creates a repulsive potential which keeps things from going out of the black hole, unless their k is equal to zero. Now that's modified because of the spherical character of the black hole, but let me just draw the potential. If this is u, we have a potential for each k which grows. The smaller the k, the longer it takes for the potential to get started. The larger the k, the earlier, by earlier, I mean deeper near the horizon, you get turned around. Okay, so there's a series of potentials, one for each value of k. Okay, if there are no questions about that, I will jump right into the spherical black hole and do the wave equation for the spherical black hole. It is not much more complicated, but it's enough more complicated that with my blackboard abilities, I prefer not to do the detailed arithmetic of it. Instead, I will simply tell you what it is. But the rules are exactly what you might expect. No subtleties. We work in tortoise coordinates. Why tortoise coordinates? Because tortoise coordinates are also conformally flat. They also have the form f of r star, I guess, times dt squared minus the r star star squared. And then, instead of having dx dx, we have r squared, now this is ordinary Schwarzschild r squared, times the omega squared. R is related to r star in a known way. This function here is a known function. We can plug it in. We have the metric. We can write the wave equation. Let chi be a minimally coupled scalar field. Because we're in spherical coordinates, as always, it's a good idea to redefine chi by multiplying it by r and calling the result psi. This takes out a factor associated with the measure of the sphere as it grows with r. If you define psi to be r times chi, then you get a very simple wave equation for psi. It's just it's a matter of really straightforward stuff. The only other thing is that I would remind you that we don't want the Fourier transform chi psi. We want to write it in the form sum YLM psi LM of R star and T. Now notice something else here. I am using T rather than omega. This is a historical glitch about the nature of tortoise coordinates that you use T there. I'm using T, which means that frequencies will be real, honest frequencies measured in ordinary time units, unlike the dimensionless frequencies here. So time, energy, frequency will all have physical units in the tortoise coordinate construction. Okay, I'm just going to write the answer. The answer is, let's call it ILM. It's the action for the LMth component of a field is 1/2 integral dTdr, dTdr star. The angular stuff is all taken care of by using spherical harmonics. And then we have 1/2 psi by dt squared minus 1/2 psi by dr star squared. Boy, this is easy. And then we have minus a potential. Now, this is not a field potential. It's not a function of psi. It's a potential, a function of position of r star times psi squared. Psi here means psi ln. This V contains things like L times L plus 1. In other words, it contains things like K squared. It contains things like E to the U. It's the analog of this. That's the V that appears in the near horizon region. In fact, for highly negative R, highly negative R star, it will basically be the same potential. It will differ when you get out to large distances. So all I need to tell you is what V of R star is. I'm going to write down what V of R star is. And let's see, do I have a spare blackboard? I think I have to erase. And I think, well, let's see. We'll see how far I can get before we get to noon. Let me write down what V is. And you can see some interesting things in it. This is really mindless calculation. There's nothing subtle. V is equal. Now, I should express it in terms of R star. But R star is a function of little r, Schwarzschild R. And I'm going to give it to you in terms of Schwarzschild R. Remember, Schwarzschild R goes to 2mg when R star goes to minus infinity. R minus 2mg divided by R. So that at the horizon, this will go to 0. And then L times L plus 1, that's like K squared, divided by R squared, plus 2mg over R cubed. So let's see what it looks like first of all. It is true that if you plug in R star for R, it will look like the same series of curves as you vary L. L is closely related to K. K and L are very similar kinds of things. Okay. They're the harmonics on the sphere or the harmonics on the plane. So as L varies, you get a series of potentials which grow with L. One of the surprises, okay, first of all, one surprise is that for L equals 0, there's a potential. And that potential is the lowest of all of them. It looks about like this. And its maximum value, let's see, in fact, all of these potentials take on their maxima. Let's see if we can see what happens to them. At large r, this all goes to 1. This is the biggest thing at large r, right? And it is just a centrifugal barrier. So far away, we see the centrifugal barrier pushing us out. Deep inside the black hole, inside the black hole is way down there, but inside the turnover of this potential, the centrifugal barrier does something peculiar. It pushes us back into the black hole. Right? So this falls down this way. And asymptotically, for large L, the maximum of the potential occurs at little r equals 3mg. Not 2mg. 2mg is way the hell back down there. 3mg is over here. All right, so it's a little bit, three halves of the way outside of the black hole. They're not, it's not exactly a 3mg, just asymptotically it approaches 3mg. They have their maximum very close to 3mg, all of them. And the height of the potential here, the height of each potential is of order, let's see, this is order 1, order 1 over r squared, 1 over mg squared. Each one of these is of order 1 over mg squared, but with a growth that grows like L times L plus 1. Right? So the higher the angular momentum, the higher it is. And the lowest one here, I think the maximum of it is something like 0.15 over mg, something like that. Let's see, over mg squared, some number. No, it's not 0.15, 0.3 or something like that. I don't remember exactly. The highest value of potential, but it's of order 1 over mg squared. Each one gets higher and higher. So what does this mean? It means, first of all, even for the S wave, if you throw in a very low energy S wave, it will get reflected back out. Even an S wave with no impact parameter at all will not get into the black hole if its energy, if its frequency is sufficiently low. And sufficiently low means that the frequency is less than 1 over mg. The frequency, the natural time scale in this problem is the transit time across the black hole, the time that it takes light to go across the black hole horizon. If the frequency is less than the inverse of that, significantly, light or anything else will just reflect off the black hole. The black hole is a perfect reflector of very, very low frequency waves. Right? But if the wavelength, even of the S wave, is above the height of this barrier, in other words, if the wavelength is somewhat shorter than the size of the black hole, then it will just penetrate right in. Of course, higher angular momenta have a centrifugal barrier, so they have to have yet higher energy to get into the black hole. The higher the angular momentum, the larger the centrifugal barrier that it has to overcome. But it will overcome it if it has enough energy, or it will tunnel through it and get to the tunnel through. Assume let's ignore tunneling for the moment. It'll either reflect off if it doesn't have enough energy, or it will go through and get into the interior, and then eventually get closer and closer to the horizon. So from the outside, you have standard centrifugal barrier, but the centrifugal barrier is sort of regulated or kept from going up to infinity by the geometry of the black hole, and it can be overcome. Okay? This is incidentally something that surprised Einstein. Einstein hated black holes. He did not like them. He didn't like the idea that things could get trapped in the black hole. And he knew from Newtonian dynamics that a thing could not contract to a point because of centrifugal barriers. That unless atoms were, you know, unless particles were absolutely aimed toward the origin, they would miss and just go back out. And so he thought that would be true of a black hole also. He missed this. He missed this turnover here. The other hand, the other interesting fact is if you start inside the black hole, when I say inside the black hole, I mean inside this 3mg. Not inside the horizon. But if you start near the horizon and shoot something out, it will also get reflected back in if it's too low in energy. If it's an S wave, it has the best chance of getting out. If its wavelength is longer than the radius of the black hole, it'll get reflected back in. If its wavelength is a little bit shorter than the radius of the black hole, it'll just go flying out. So stuff from behind here, if it's an S wave, has a good chance of getting out. On the other hand, of the same comparable energy, also let's talk about wavelengths of order the size of the black hole. If it has L equals 1, it has much less chance of getting out. If it has L of 1, about the same wavelength, it'll get reflected back. It may tunnel out. But the higher the angular momentum, the harder it is to get out. Now, I'll just tell you, you all know probably that black holes have a temperature. The quanta that are in here are in thermal equilibrium. We'll see why that is next time. I don't think we'll get to it today. They're in thermal equilibrium. They have a temperature corresponding to a frequency which is about this high. The S wave quanta get out. But if you look inside the thermal quanta inside or near the horizon, they're mostly all higher angular momentum. Zero angular momentum is an exception. It's the particular quanta that happen to be going perfectly radially out. Most quanta that are emitted from the horizon simply fall back down onto the horizon because they encounter this barrier. It's only the ones which are moving practically radially, perfectly straight out, which corresponds to zero angular momentum, that have any chance of getting out. So that's why the black hole evaporation is slow. It's slow because only one angular momentum out of all the possible angular momenta leak out of the black hole. Once all the S waves have leaked out of the black hole, it can't evaporate anymore. Well, that's not true. Why? Because scattering can take place among the quanta. And when scattering takes place, it can renew the S waves. So scattering taking place in here can renew the S waves, but it's kind of a slow process where only the S waves get out of the black hole. Maybe a little bit of P wave. And so the black hole slowly dribbles away its energy. But almost everything, all the higher angular momentum quanta, which are emitted from the surface of the black hole in non-radial directions, mostly just fall back down as a consequence of this potential barrier.
Can you explain in words why it comes back in that case where that we're looking at?
It's exactly what we said before. Here's the horizon.
I don't know what you said before, but I mean, is this case where contributing to the energy momentum tensor that gets attracted to the center of the black hole, is that the physics of it?
Probably, but I'm much more inclined to just throw this piece of chalk and say that's why it came back down.
Yeah, but
there's a strong gravitational field near the horizon.
But that it comes back, it means that there's always a bound state. Classically,
there's a tunneling barrier, so it's not quite a bad state, but
So, well, what's going on? Why does it do that?
Gravity pulls it back.
Be much more than classical.
This isn't
it isn't like that.
This is classical. This is classical wave equations. It's classical.
The higher angular momentum, you say it classically, it will come back sooner?
Yeah.
Okay,
Here's your black hole. Angular momentum at a given radius means R cross P, right? So we're out at the Schwarzschild radius. Angular momentum basically means the horizontal component of the momentum. The higher the angular momentum means the shallower the angle. The shallower the angle, the more likely it is just to fall back down. That's all. It's perfectly classical effect, perfectly classical particle effect. There's a very narrow cone that corresponds to particles being able to get out, classically. And when I say classically, I mean let's pick some momentum. Let's pick a momentum, it doesn't really matter what momentum, but let's pick Planck momentum. Supposing things are emitted near the horizon, Planck momentum. All right? So they have the Planck momentum, they have the Schwarzschild radius, and that's their angular momentum. if they happen to be in that direction. Their angular momentum is basically Schwarzschild momentum times Planck momentum. If they're pointing in this direction, they have a hard angular momentum. If they happen to be pointing radially out, then they have no angular momentum, and they get out. That's all. That's all that's going on. And it's a purely classical particle phenomenon translated into Schrodinger equation language. That's all that's going on. Most quanta, simply, whether they were classical, quantum mechanical, or anything else, would just fall back down onto the horizon. If they happen to be radially outward, they get a chance to go out. Okay, any questions? I think I was going to go on to do a little bit of thermodynamics and show you why the black hole has temperature, but I I don't think that's a 5-minute project. It's probably a 7-minute project. It is. It's only 7 minutes.
Thank you.